Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit Michter's.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I am here today with Mr. Hugh Davies. He is the proprietor of the great Schramsberg Vineyards out in Napa Valley, California, making what I think are the pretty much the greatest American sparkling wines. I remember just a few years back, I was tasked with writing an article for the Beverage Media on California sparkling wines. And I had organized, I'm sure he's heard me tell this story a few times, but I organized a big blind tasting for all the California sparkling wines I could get. And there were quite a few tasty ones. And I organized them by style, whether it was rosé, Blanc de Blanc, Blanc de Noir, and boy, Schramsberg pretty much won in every category blind with all of our industry friends. So that was a fun time and just reconfirmed how much I love these wines and how excited I am to have you on the show. Welcome, Hugh.
Hey, thanks, Joe. That's a good story. I like it. So I'm excited that the folks like the wines. We aim to please.
Nice. So Schramsberg's an historic property in the Napa Valley, has been around since the mid-19th century, kind of an interrupted past, if you will. But it's really your parents who brought Schramsberg to the great recognition that it is today. They purchased the vineyard in 1965 and completely restored the property. So they did such a good job, in fact, that it's been something that's been served to multiple presidents. Can you tell us, how did Schramsberg first get started being served to presidents? And has Barack Obama ever had any Schramsberg?
We've had a few instances, I think four now, during the Obama administration that we're aware of. That have happened. At the initial time one of our wines was served at an official White House function was actually in Beijing, China, and it was in 1972. My parents had revived the old Schramsberg winery in the 60s, in 1965, and at that time they would be the first to make Chardonnay and Pinot Noir based sparkling wines in this traditional, you know, bottle fermentation method. And about 7 years later, you know, I guess sometimes being the first is helpful, but Nixon had gone to China. There was a big toast to peace. We were still in the midst of the Vietnamese conflict, and the Chinese were on one side and we were on the other. But they raised a glass to peace, and as it turned out, as Barbara Walters would explain the next day on the Today Show, that a little-known sparkling wine, the Schramsberg Blanc de Blanc, had been served, and she showed a bottle on national television. That was good.
That's pretty great. The beginning of mending of our relations with China.
And I think for me it's still exciting to reflect upon, to consider, because you know that just doesn't always happen, right? It's hard to somehow. It's almost a magical thing that you would be in the right place at the right time. But you've got to figure, for my parents who had come up with the idea and then invested in this old property and worked so hard to kind of get it up and running, that was a pretty good thing to have happen.
Now that blanc de blanc or blanc de blanc, as we might say. Now it's something that we poured by the glass for quite some time at La Picho. We still have it on our bottle list along with a couple of your other wines. Something that I really like. It's really in kind of a lean, crisp, dry style that I think really is very, very food friendly. Pairs with a lot of our dishes. And has that always been the style? Have you guys changed through the years? I know with the Blanc de Noir, at least, it used to be Blanc de Gamay. Is that
correct? That was a third wine that we made. Yeah, the Cuvée de Gamay. which is morphed really to what we do today, called the rosé. And so the rosé style is a lot more popular today than it was 10 years ago, not just for us, but for other producers throughout the globe. Certainly those who are marketing the United States, the category is popped a little bit. But the Blanc de Blanc, which you had done by the glass, and we appreciate that, is lighter in body than the other styles we do. It's 100% Chardonnay, and so it's probably a little Chardonnay and Pinot are the two principal varieties we use. The Pinot is a little more fleshy and juicy and round, whereas the Chardonnay is crisp and more citrusy and tart and long on the finish too. That's a nice palate cleansing style.
Yeah, very, very refreshing. You know, we have at La Petra, I feel like we have a lot of newer California producers who are making much more food friendly wines, and a couple classics. And I think that you guys have been making very food friendly style wines, lower alcohol, crisp acidity, drier sparkling wines for a while. And I love them, and I'm proud to serve them.
Awesome. No, that's it does somewhat go with the territory. We're making a style that is certainly similar to a champagne from France, where you use the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir grapes and you pick the fruit at low sugars and end up with a low alcohol wine with a lot of acidity. As we've evolved, we've actually moved with vineyards closer to the coast to cooler pockets where the acidity is higher in the juice as we pick the fruit. And I think we fine-tuned the style, you know, always trying to get a little bit better with what we're doing.
Now, talk about a little bit about your evolving. Now you work with 90 different parcels. It could be off by...
It's probably a little more like 110.
110 parcels. Yeah. How do you maintain quality and create a wine that maybe that represents terroir? Or are you looking for a wine that represents terroir with working with so many different parcels?
Yeah, I think, you know, you think of the traditional French champagne model is there's the assemblage, you know, that's the term that is used. And so from multiple sources, obviously in our case, they're all in Northern California. They're in what's known as the North Coast. We have, I guess I could say handpicked, but over the course of years, sifted through a number of different sites and now have, assembled, a set that's as good as I think we've ever had, but we wouldn't just stick with that set. We would continue to try a couple of new things every year that might give us that many more pieces to work with as we build a blend. The sites can be lower in elevation when closer to the bay or in some of the coastal valleys, but as you get a little closer to the ocean itself, you might be up a little bit higher. So there's just enough sun. You get too close to the sea level next to the water, it does get a little bit challenging to get the fruit to ripen, even for a fairly low alcohol sparkling wine.
And now there's a movement in Champagne towards vinifying single vineyard or very site-specific wines. I would love to try a Schramsberg vineyard. Have you done it before?
Yeah, no, yeah. We have a couple of vineyard designated wines that we have done, and we're starting to hear people more, I'd say, in the you know, the wine media, potentially some of the sommelier crowd. There is that interest in, you know, in tasting, you know, what that site tastes like. You know, just that block right there. I want to taste that 1 acre, and that's it. And so, typically, each year on a smaller scale, we're doing some vineyard designate bottlings, and then they come out when they're typically 5 years old. They're not in broader distribution. We've done them for our wine club, and we have a pretty good following with the club, and so that's one way to reward those guys.
Yeah, I guess what if there is a trend or something that's hot or something picks up interest, it takes you quite a few years to adjust to that, considering the vinification process and aging process.
It is a process. So we've released a Tognetti, which is a site on Bayview Avenue in Napa Grande Rose. It's a really good site, dark, loamy soils. Neighboring that are the Hyde vineyards, and we've done a Hyde Also in that neighborhood is a Jones, which we've done. All of them focus, those ones, primarily on Chardonnay. As we've done things more out towards the coast, some of our best Pinot Noirs feeling like they may come from places in Marin County mm-hmm. or up the Sonoma coast into Mendocino's Anderson Valley. We actually bottled a couple of years ago a Redding, which is a Redding Ranch, which is a site in Marin up in the hills. You're probably up 1,000 feet above mm-hmm. sea level there. Multiple clones of Pinot Noir, but it is a Pinot Noir. It's probably a Blanc Noir, but just from that site near Nicasio.
Going County. Back to the idea of blending, do you already know when you're planting or ahead of time where the specific plots will go into which wines, or is that more of a game time decision as the fruit comes in and it's tasted and then you further blend it off? I'm sure that in terms of skin contact, the red wines, you have to make those decisions earlier on, I'd imagine.
Yeah, the way we roll is that we'll make from, you know, over 100 different relatively small blocks. We're not a big producer. We have national distribution, but we're still, you know, relatively small in that regard. We have the ability to make maybe 200, and I think last year we made 275 individual base wines. What's a base wine? It's the vin tranquille. It's the white wine, either made from the Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, that is probably going to be sitting at about 11.5% alcohol. It's crisp. It's tart. It's young. We do tank fermentations with most of the volume, but we do a really deep set of barrel fermented wines as well. Some will go through malolactic fermentation. Some won't. And so we have a really broad range of components to work with. We think that's very exciting, and from the broad range of sites. It's only once we get to blending. So if harvest is August, September, October, it's January, February, March where we start to put pieces together from the set of base wines, initially identifying the very best ones that we think we might have to work with, narrowing that list down to say 25 or 30, and from those we put together our tête de cuvées. So we do make a few tête de cuvées that are the limited special select offerings, and we'll age those guys for up to 8 years after we put those wines together.
Switching things up a little bit, can you tell us about a super fun, interesting, delicious domestic sparkling wine that you've had that you did not make?
Oh, that we did not make? That's a good question. There are a number of really fine producers, and there are some new smaller lots that we're starting to see. I think I probably think of some of the folks that have been around a little bit longer for maybe the best quality that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I don't know everything, right? There's probably something that is so outstanding that I've not yet tasted. But we think pretty highly, certainly, of the folks at Roeder Estate. I think they've done a fine job. The L'Hermitage, their top of the line is that's pretty darn good. Yeah. And delicious. I think it is it's a style that really rivals the very best in Champagne in my mm-hmm. mind. I don't say that just because I'm from California. At a fraction of the price, people should just be drinking it right and left. In my mind, that's a good one. The folks at Domaine Carneros, I think, are doing a good job. The guys at Mum, there are a number of producers in California. I think as a set, we're a lot better than the world really realizes.
Have you ever tried to make a Petillant Naturel wine?
No.
Do you have any desire? Do you have any interest in this category?
I think I need to explore it a little bit further before, I think if you put something in the bottle, you want to make sure that it works and that all the bottles that you make that are this item are going to be the same and mm-hmm. are going to age similarly. So you wouldn't want them to be potentially short-lived or to be inconsistent. And so I think you want to fine-tune your technique before you start moving commercially with it, with your name on it.
All right. All right, so we're going to take just a quick break. We'll be back with more of Hugh Davies from Schramsberg Vineyards in a bit.
Awesome.
Great.
You are listening to Let Me In by Snowmine here on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Michter's Whiskey is a proud sponsor of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. If you drink the whiskey that warmed General Washington's troops at Valley Forge, does that make you a patriot? Not necessarily, but it indicates you appreciate that Michter sets the standard for highest quality, limited production whiskeys. America's first whiskey distilling company, Michter's rich history dates back to 1753, when a farmer in Schaeferstown, Pennsylvania, distilled his first batch of whiskey from Hardy Rye. At one point, a master distiller left his family's well-known distillery to join Michter's so he could be at a smaller, less cost-conscious company where he could make the finest whiskey, cost be damned. Ask your bartender or retailer for Michter's whiskey today. Chatham Imports is the national sales agent for Michter's Distillery. For more information, please visit www.michters.com. That's www.michters.com.
And we're back with Hugh Davies, the proprietor of Stromsburg Vineyards here on In the Drink. And before we left, we did talk a little bit about my desire for maybe one day for Hugh to try making a Petit Naturel wine. I think that would be a lot of fun. I just wanted to give you guys a heads up. There is a California Pet Nat out there that I'm a big fan of called 25 Reasons by Selenia. Pretty well priced as well. It's Sauvignon Blanc. It doesn't taste very Sauvignon Blanc-y, which is I think a nice thing. And it's a little bit earthy, yeasty, great acidity. It's more of a fun wine, but I would say look for that. And that's a recent sparkling wine that I've tasted that I really enjoy. So look for that one.
And it doesn't have to take that long to make it necessarily.
Doesn't have to take years to make it. Yeah, so that's a nice thing.
Yep.
What is your cellar like? How many bottles do you have in the various processes?
Oh, well, we do make a number of offerings that are relatively old as they come to market. You think of the J-Shram, you think of the Reserve, the J-Shram yep. Rosé. Those guys are currently 2005, 2006 vintage, so they're 8, 9 years old.
So you might have eight vintages of those wines in your cellar.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, we were making, collectively in that set, it's 4,000 or 5,000 cases a year. So that's times 12, 60,000 bottles times 8. There's 500,000 of those guys.
That's a lot of square footage.
It's they're about 35,000 square feet of floor space. There is that much in the caves at Schramsberg, and they're pretty much full of bottles. I think today we're close with everything that we've got in there from the Blanc de Blanc, Blanc Noir, Rosé, et cetera. There are about 3 million bottles.
So who? That's a ton of
bottles. But it's about 4 years worth of inventory.
Yeah, I recently went to in the Emidio Pepe Winery. In Abruzzo, you think of them as the tiniest, most artisanal, handmade, organic family winery, and they have 500,000 bottles in their cellar because they're aging quite a bit of it. So
as well, and on larger scale, you think of the big French houses, Moët Chandon, Veuve Clicquot. They're large and known and popular. You think of champagne in general,
mm-hmm.
But if you look at the overall amount of champagne made every year in that district of France is 25 million cases. You know, that's a lot of bottles. So that's getting up there towards 300 million bottles. The larger producers would do maybe, you know, I think Moët's probably pushing 3 million cases, 2.5 million cases, something like that.
So Moët's doing 10% of the entire production of champagne.
Yeah. I think all of the LVMH group put together, I mean, I'm not the expert. I don't know, but as I understand it, yeah, it's probably 30-35% all champagne is Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy.
That is absolutely brands. Nuts. That is absolutely
And they do, crazy. I mean, they make some pretty good stuff.
They make some pretty good stuff, yeah.
So you don't have to be, you know, the tiny small guy to be able to make it good. I think that but it's exciting to meet the tiny small guy who's carved out a niche, who's created something out of one plot and presents it and it's beautiful.
And so let's change pace a little bit. Who's drinking the majority of your wine? What's the market for California sparkling wine?
The market for California sparkling wine is definitely primarily the United States. I'd say the market for California wine in general is primarily the United States. If you look at the California wine segment, it's about 85% distributed in the United States and maybe 15% thereabouts exported. With our brand, we're probably more like 95 and 5, and I'd say that's probably the case for the California sparkling category in general. It's not a large category. If you think of, well, there are different tiers, but if you think of the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir based bottle fermented, you know, kind of classic method sparklings like champagne, but in California, we're doing about 1 million cases collectively compared to the 25 million. So it's pretty small. And so there's of that, you know, obviously the vast majority of it is consumed here in the States.
Now, you were the chairperson for a year of the Napa Valley Vintners and served on the board for a number of years as well. What are the main issues today that the vintners talk about? What are the things that face you guys? What were your meetings like?
No, and to some degree, some of the issues are the same as they might have been, you know, 10, 20 years ago. I think right now we're struggling a little bit in Napa, or community. Struggle is maybe too strong of a word, but working to find the best path forward as far as how do we manage growth? How do we manage the popularity for visiting wineries, for how do we manage crowds? You know, how do we plan for the future? How are we going to move people around? How are we going to, as the industry has grown, as the world does? I mean, we may be facing problems that other people have too. Where are we going to get the water? You know, how are we going to manage, a larger population and still be able to have agricultural land and room to grow the crops and do what we're doing.
And what are some of the proposals?
Well, we have regulations, and they date back to the 60s. And frankly, had we not adopted regulations back in the 60s, we wouldn't have the Napa Valley as we know it. So those regulations are starting with zoning restrictions. We are required to have outside of the existing urban pockets, or the pre-existing urban pockets, the land in Napa County was zoned for agriculture. And so on the valley floor, we now have 40-acre minimum parcel sizes so that you cannot subdivide a parcel if you had a parcel to sizes smaller than 40 acres. And so that keeps as one house per 40 acres. That's it. And there's no commercial activity that you could apply to that parcel. There's no although now we're starting to struggle a little bit with that with wineries. You know, how much commercial activity, what constitutes commercial, you know, what's required to sell the wine that the winery is making versus you know, what might be over the top. You don't want to have a hotel, a restaurant, you know, a gas station, et cetera, on the winery property as well, because that would kind of defeat the purpose. So the zoning plays a big role. We've already alluded to a little bit here, what constitutes a winery. So we have a winery definition ordinance that gives the county the ability to restrict what wineries can do, how many people they can have visit, when they can visit. I could go on and on, but yeah, and I think that it's a source of consternation for some folks who think everybody should be able to do whatever they want to do. Right? Yeah. It's America. It's a free country. But at the same time, had we not had some of these restrictions, then we wouldn't have the industry that we've got. We wouldn't have the extraordinary place that we have and that I call home. So I'm it's okay with me to be a bit restrictive.
It's not the overbearing hand of the government, or in this case, a trade group.
The trade group is kind of, I think, playing historically has and continues to play a role working with the government that not only represents the industry, but also yeah. the other constituents.
It makes total sense to me because I think humans left to our own devices will act really poorly. You kind of need some referees in order to make sure that... that we stay in bounds.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a hard thing to accept. You put it in a different way, just from the standpoint of we need to preserve agricultural land in California. You look at the statistics, we're losing 30,000 acres of ag land in California every year. We're not losing it in Napa County. We haven't lost any ag land in Napa County. Crazy, right? Given that this has been going on, the loss of ag land. But as the California population approaches 40 million people, obviously, you know, they need space to build houses and to exist. So you are losing a lot of that fertile ground in what's the San Joaquin Valley, the Sacramento Valley. You know, fast forward 50, 100 years, you know, it's a little bit frightening because mm-hmm. if that pace continues, that's a lot of land that's paved over.
Yeah, well, talking about the future, but more specifically about Stromsburg, I know you recently released a line of Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Delicious, at the J. Davies Farrington.
That is the Davies Vineyard Farrington Pinot from the Anderson Valley. That's a specific site. We've done a fair amount of work up there with Pinot Noir, mostly, but some Chardonnay for our sparkling wines. And so there, for the last... Well, now we've done a 9, 10, 11 was the one that we had at the dinner, and there's a 12 and a 13, so we've actually done five vintages of Farrington, Anderson Valley, Pinot, and we've done a couple of others. There's a Nobles Vineyard, which is up in the Sonoma Coast, again, a specific vineyard-designated wine. We do have a mix of clones there, so we make a few different iterations of the Nobles or the Farrington before crafting the specific blend. And we'll continue to move forward with that. We got started doing a little bit of red wine with our home property there on Diamond Mountain in the Napa Valley where the Stransburg Winery is located. Mm-hmm. It occurred to us, as it had already occurred to others around us, that Cabernet Sauvignon might really work the best in those hillside vineyards that we had. And so in the early 90s, we started the replanting. The estate Cabernet that we produce is called J. Davies. So we named that in honor of my dad, Jack, so using his initial.
Also the founder, Jay Schramm, right? Wasn't he?
No. So it gets a little confusing. The Schramms or the Schramms were there in the 1800s.
Yeah.
There was a guy, Jacob Schramm, and
Jacob
so we
Schramm.
Have.
Wasn't he the guy who started it?
He started the winery, and in 1862, the middle of the Civil War, there wasn't a whole lot going on out there in California. But he started it, so there is a little bit of a nexus, if you will. You know, the J. Davies, you know, named after Jack Davies, but that's Cabernet, and the J. Schramm, which is our kind of signature best Blanc style, so Chardonnay based brut.
All right, don't get them confused like I did.
Hey, it's I do it every day, so it's okay.
Do you have any interest in making a dry still Chardonnay? That seems like a logical
seems
next
like a
step.
Natural. I think I'm right? Back to your other proposition for a different type of sparkling. I think you want
not that I think we need another Napa need Valley another, Chardonnay. I think we have more than enough.
Maybe Sauvignon Blanc.
Maybe Sauvignon Blanc.
That might make my wife happy. She likes Sauvignon Blanc. But the I think we're gonna just take one step at a time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're working hard. We're enjoying what we do. It feels like it's really working, and you never say never. But for the time being, we're focused on the small amount of red wine activity with Cab and Pinot. And then continuing to build upon our success with the sparkling.
Well, as I said before, I think the sparkling wines are absolutely delicious, really, really incredible, and part of the ever-changing history of California, really historic state. So I also like thinking about that when drinking them. So that's fantastic. And it's great that we get to enjoy them probably in the greatest time they've ever been. And that's in a large part due to your work. So thank you very much.
No, it's I feel blessed. I'm lucky to have the chance to do what I do. So I appreciate your enthusiasm for what we're doing.
All right, Hugh. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.